We're talking about the Supreme Court term that ended Thursday. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Two big rulings came down on that last day, partisan gerrymandering and the citizenship question on the 2020 census. And those two things drill down to this fundamental question of how our political system functions. The High Court decided many cases narrowly this term. The court overruled two precedents. So what do you think about the rulings that came down? Are you optimistic about our government, or do you have concerns? What do you think about the partisan gerrymandering ruling in particular? We're at 800-642-1234. You can join the conversation right now. Ed Miller is an emeritus professor of political science at UW-Stevens Point. He's former co-chair for the Redistricting Committee for the Wisconsin Supreme Court. He's also co-director of the Center for the Small City. Ed, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
So let's start with gerrymandering. Last week, the Supreme Court ruled that partisan gerrymandering fell beyond the reach of the federal courts. Lots of reporting around this. What did we learn from that ruling? What does it mean for us?
Well, it means that they can draw the districts in ways that have great, very partisan. Wisconsin is one of the most extreme in the country. In Wisconsin, where the Democrats received in the assembly 56% of the votes, they only received a small percentage of the seats. They received 30, a third of the seats. And so it shows you how you can draw districts in such a way, even though they're equal in population, that you can draw districts so that they're basically unequal in terms of partisan makeup of the legislature. Now, the Supreme Court has been working on this for many, many years. And what they reversed was the question is whether this is something that can be decided by the court. And the Supreme Court decided that it could be decided by the court for many, many years. The only thing they said was they did not have an adequate measure of how do you determine when something is partisan gerrymandered and when something is not, and when the court should intervene. Well, Kennedy, Justice Kennedy was always on the border there. He was about to rule against partisan gerrymandering in a last case, but then he is off the court now. He retired from the court, and the court, and as you mentioned in the 5-4 decision, decided that partisan gerrymandering is what they call non-justiciable. In other words, it's something to be decided by essentially by the legislature and not by the judicial body.
Oh, it becomes this political question that federal courts can't fix.
Right. And it becomes a little bit somewhat strange because in terms of racial gerrymandering, the court has continued to intercede in racial gerrymandering cases and ordering the redrawing of the district. But in terms of partisan gerrymandering, they have not. Now, the argument is that under racial gerrymandering, they do have the Voting Rights Act and the application of the Voting Rights Act. But in terms of partisan gerrymandering, you still have the right of individuals to make determinations as to who represents them.
So the Supreme Court was scheduled to decide on a gerrymandering case from Wisconsin called Gill versus Whitford. And then yesterday, that case was dismissed by that three panel of federal judges. So does this mark the end of Wisconsin's legal fights over this issue?
Well, it probably does. And as you mentioned, that the federal court has dismissed the case. The situation is a serious situation. In Wisconsin, it not only was the way they drew the districts, but it was it was how they did it. And the Republican Party in the legislature essentially did it using a private attorney or a law firm, rather than having it normally done through what in Wisconsin is the Technical Service Bureau, which is a legislative bureau. So it was done privately. All the maps, everything that was done was kept secret and was not shown to the Democrats. And even the Republicans that came in to see the maps could not take notes or anything like this. So it was all done. And in addition to that, a number of the materials that under Wisconsin's open record laws would normally be available to the citizens are not in Wisconsin. Some of it, they say, was lost, and they refused to give it. And there was a lot of issues with regard to that. In addition to that, in Wisconsin, we had a law. And the law in Wisconsin said you could not draw the state districts until the local government had drawn their districts. And the reason was so that there would not be state legislative districts that crossed a local government district line. Well, normally, when they get the census and where local government draws the districts, they finish up. We actually did a survey of this for courts from the clerks of courts and asking them when these would be finished. Well, they said it would be finished in around September, about mid-September. So that's when the legislature would then normally start doing their districting. Well, in the year that they did it, there was those special elections. And the concern of the Republicans was that they would lose control, particularly of the Senate. And there were several special elections. And so that was during the summer, those elections. So they wound up doing the districts before the local government had done their districts and repealed that law at the same time. And so when Governor Walker signed the redistricting bill, he signed at the same time the bill to repeal this law. So in effect, I raised some questions here because they were operating under a law that said they couldn't do it.
So timing was certainly an issue here. Ed Miller, an emeritus professor of political science, UW-Stevens Point, former co-chair for the redistricting committee for the Wisconsin Supreme Court. You can join in 800-642-1234. What do you think about the latest Supreme Court rulings? Are you optimistic about our government? Do you have concerns? Share your thoughts on the citizenship question, on the census. Share your thoughts on gerrymandering. Gerrymandering verdict, 800-642-1234. Ed Miller, the Supreme Court blocked a citizenship question from being added to the 2020 census in a 5-4 vote. And Trump administration wanted the question on the census forms sent to our households. But then yesterday, we learned the census decided to print the forms without the citizenship question on it. Why did the Trump administration want the question added?
Well, they wanted the question added, whether it's if you look at their explanation or you look at probably what happened. What happened was that there was a political strategist who has since died. And this political strategist, as a matter of fact, it was found more recently in his computer files that he had advocated the census question to essentially suppress the vote. And it would be suppress the vote of those who would tend to be concerned about voting if there was a citizen question. So you have to be a citizen to vote. So, but if some individuals who are concerned about that question, like particularly with to vote, you have to be a citizen, but not to answer the citizen question on the census. Everybody responds to the census. So if you're here and you're an immigrant, whether you're an undocumented immigrant or you're a documented immigrant, you may be concerned about this question that asks about your citizenship.
And we have to pause right there with Ed Miller as our guide, a UW-Stevens Point professor emeritus, political science. You can join in 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on the 2020 census printed without the citizenship question? Join in. You can email ideas, WPR.org. We'll get back to reviewing the Supreme Court decisions, their implications, maybe hear from you on the Ideas Network. We're poring over the decisions from the recently completed SCOTUS term on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. High Court decided 74 cases. It reversed lower court decisions at a rate of 65%. That's the lowest rate since the 2015 term. Gathering your questions, looking closer at the rulings, the divided Supreme Court blocked the Trump administration from adding an untested citizenship question to the 2020 census. So how do you feel about this ruling? The court's majority said the government has the right to ask a citizen citizenship question, but that needs to properly justify changing the longstanding practice of the Census Bureau. And then President Trump expressed frustration last night that the 2020 census will not include this question, adding that his administration is not giving up on the fight. Join in at 800-642-1234. Ed Miller is our guide. He is a political scientist from UW-Stevens Point, and he stays with us. Let's go to the phones now with Ryan joining us from Wausau. Hi, Ryan. Ryan, are you there? No, we can't hear Ryan at this point. But, you know, I want to ask you, Ed Miller, how will the information collected from the 2020 census be used? What is the purpose?
Well, the purpose, the Constitution under Article 1 of the Constitution, which is actually the Congress section, requires the census every 10 years. And the primary use of the census is to determine your number of representatives, members of the House of Representatives, per state. And so after the census, they will determine how many. So, for example, Wisconsin lost a member of the – actually, over the several decades, we've lost two members of the House of Representatives based upon population. So that is what the Constitution says with regard to the census. The census is also used in formulas to distribute financial assistance to states. So federal aid to states often are determined by a number of factors, including poverty of a state, but also the number of people in a state or the number of people in a local area. So particularly larger cities that have more migrants, those individuals were the ones to be most harmed by having the citizen question on there.
Well, I understand Ryan is back with us now. Ryan, hi.
Hello.
What's on your
good
mind?
Morning.
Yeah, good morning.
I believe that the question should be on there, and I don't understand what the problem with it should be. When you're not a citizen of the country, you shouldn't be able to represent at any point. So you're saying that, you know, by having it on there, you're going to deter people, but by not having it on there, you're going to promote people that are not part of our country to state what they would, you know, what to alter the state of our country. So in my eyes, it's a legitimate question.
Ryan, thanks for the call. Ed Miller, how would you respond to that?
Well, okay. Well, the first thing is that only citizens can vote. So it has nothing to do with voting. And so those who are selecting the representatives can only be citizens. Now, and by the way, at one time, you didn't have to be citizens to vote. I think in Wisconsin, it was in the 1920s that they required individuals to be citizens to vote. Before that, non-citizens actually could vote. But okay, so you have to be a citizen to vote. But the Constitution says that everyone who's living in an area is to be counted. And so the consequence is that you would count individuals who are there, whether they're citizens or non-citizens, whether they're so the idea isn't that they're telling individuals or telling members of Congress what their position is and they're determining policy. But what it is it's the determination of that representative is representing all the people, whether the people vote or not. So, for example, and you're moving away from citizenship, children can't vote. You have to be 18 to vote now. It used to be 21 many years ago, but it's 18 to vote. But children who are 2 years old and 3 years old are counted in the census, but obviously can't vote. That's the same thing with in terms of citizens. Now, the question is, do we know how many citizens there are in this country? And the answer is yes, because the Census Bureau also conducts a survey, and they do this survey, which does ask the citizenship question on the survey, but that survey can't be used to allocate representatives. So we do know they do ask every single year, but they do not ask the citizenship question on the census because individuals and every single person who is a survey person will tell you that that will suppress the vote. Suppress the number of people counted.
Ryan, thanks for the call. Let's look a little bit at the new court makeup. The court is adjusting to the departure, as you said earlier, of Justice Anthony Kennedy. Its longtime swing vote, his replacement, Justice Brett Kavanaugh, was expected to really shift the court's center of gravity. Let's bring in Matt now in Madison with a look at this. Matt, hi.
Hello. So I had just a quick questions. So the first is just, since we have split government, will the governor be able to dictate after the census occurs, or will the Republicans have a veto override? And the second one is there hope for changing partisan gerrymandering from the state courts? And then I'll just take my answer offline.
Matt, thanks so much for the question. I thought he was talking about something else there. Ed Miller, go ahead.
Right. In Wisconsin, it's interesting because in Wisconsin, when the legislature creates the maps, the governor has to sign the new redistricting in Wisconsin. And so Governor Evers could veto the new maps that would be created after, this upcoming census. And then the legislature does have the power to override that if they could, if they could override the governor's veto. But the governor does have a veto. In some states, the governor on the maps does not have a veto. The other issue is whether we could do it another way. Well, Governor Evers put in the budget. We have a strange situation in Wisconsin where they put a lot of policy material in the state budget. And they've been, groups have recommended not doing that for decades, but we do that. So Governor Evers put in that we would create a nonpartisan commission to do the redistricting, which a number of states has. The most famous around, close to us, is Iowa, nonpartisan districting. Well, Republicans took that out of the budget. So can citizens then do that is the question. Well, in some states, the citizens can do it themselves. So, for example, in Colorado and in California, the citizens have what's called the power of the initiative. So the citizens circulated a petition. They got sufficient signatures. It then went on the ballot. People voted, and they put in a nonpartisan commission. In Wisconsin, we do not have the power of the initiative. So you can't do it in Wisconsin. You can get an initiative by the counties as an advisory initiative. And we've done that in a number of cases, such as the people voted, for example, to expand the Medicaid, who's qualified for Medicaid, mm-hmm. the so-called Medicaid expansion. But it's not law. But in Colorado and in California, it is. And as a matter of fact, that went to the Supreme Court, whether the citizens can override the legislature's determination, and the Supreme Court said that they could. And so a number of states have this commission, but we don't have in Wisconsin. And the legislature, at least under the probably under Democrats, too, would not put in this because it would be taking away their power.
Ed Miller, the Supreme Court said last Friday that it'll hear arguments whether the Trump administration illegally tried to end the Obama-era immigration program that we call DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. What do we know about this program and what will happen in the courts?
Well, the Trump administration, or Trump in particular, because he signed the executive order, was to overturn the DACA program, and the court has so far stopped that. So the DACA program is still going on. There was another program that that Obama had also signed in executive order, and that program was for the parents of those young people who are in the country, and that has been stopped by the courts, and so by lower courts, not the Supreme Court. And so that's never going into effect. Now, with the DACA program, the basis of President Obama's signature is that the president or any executive can determine what cases are prosecuted. It's called prosecutorial discretion. And so the basis for DACA is that, look, we're not going to prosecute all the cases. You can't. There's no place can you prosecute all the violations. So you've got to determine what you're going to prosecute. And so the DACA program was created under this idea.
And we have to pause right there on DACA with Ed Miller as our guide, Emeritus Professor of Political Science at UW Stevens Point. What do you think of the high court rulings? How do they impact your life? Join in at 800-642-1234. The SCOTUS look continues right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're reviewing this hour the actions taken by the U.S. Supreme Court in its recently ended term last Thursday. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Last Friday, the court said it will hear arguments whether the Trump administration illegally tried to end the Obama-era immigration program known as DACA, standing for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Talking about this with Ed Miller, who stays with us. He's an emeritus professor of political science at UW Stevens Point. So what questions do you have about DACA and the Supreme Court's review? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Ed, going back to this DACA conversation that we got started before the break, what is the issue facing the Supreme Court regarding DACA? What's being argued here?
Well, I think that the argument is, can President Trump end the DACA program? And it's strangely enough, both with many Republicans and Democrats believe in the DACA program. And it's been battered back and forth in the Congress whether to formally add the DACA program legislatively. And that got tied up with an immigration reform bill and the wall and the like. So it remains an executive order. So when it goes to the Supreme Court, the issue will be, can the president reverse that executive order? And I think that the president can, because, as I said, it was prosecutorial discretion. It was done by an executive order by President Obama. So if it was done by President's executive order, it would seem to me that it could be undone by a president's executive order, and that would be President Trump. However, those individuals who registered for the DACA program, in other words, who have already put their name in, the court may say that they're protected. And the reason is that when they were granted this idea that they could stay in the country, that in fact is they gave their name, their address, and all this material. And so the court may say that to then say they will be expelled from the country, the court may say that that would be a Fifth Amendment violation. That in fact is that they gave this information with the idea that they would stay in the country. But any future expansions of DACA would not occur. And that's my guess what the Supreme Court would say.
Well, crystal ball here, Ed Miller, will DACA be a blockbuster battle? Will it be how we remember this court?
I think, well, it could be. And DACA is a major issue in immigration reform. And so the president is trying to use DACA as a leverage and saying to the Democrats, look, you know, I will agree to, and the Republicans, which go along with him, I will agree to the DACA program if you provide certain immigration changes that I am recommending and the wall. He's very strong on the wall. And, of course, it will not be taken up by the court until next year. And soon the time will run out. We're coming up with another presidential election.
Well, a number of Democratic presidential candidates are opposing the president's decision to end DACA, and this was certainly a topic of conversation in the first Democratic debate last week. What are you taking away from Democrats debating this program and their stance on DACA? Are they unified at all?
I think the Democrats are unified on DACA. Absolutely. And in the legislature. But the Democrats don't control the Senate, and the majority leader determines what comes up in the Senate. And so, consequently, the DACA will not be legislatively approved unless, as I say, it's part of a broader immigration bill that they pass.
So, depending on how DACA is ruled, how will that impact immigration? What will change?
Well, if DACA is ruled, it means that the children who were brought here by their parents would then have, and they, if they're not granted asylum, of course they could be granted asylum, but pending not being granted asylum, they would be deported. And many of these children that are now here in this country have known no other countries. They came here, they were like, you know, 1 year old or 2 years old or something like this, and they've gone through education in the United States. Many states have given them the right to drive, you know, license. They go through high school here, and a number of states have given them, for example, in-state tuition to go to college and the like. And so these individuals technically would have to be deported to countries they've never known.
Okay, so as you look at the Supreme Court makeup now, you know, we see Justice Brett Kavanaugh, who was expected to shift the courts to the right and really thrust Chief Justice John Roberts into the court's ideological center. How would the court approach DACA as we see it? I mean, who is the swing vote now?
Well, the swing vote, as you mentioned, is Chief Justice Roberts. He's clearly now in the middle. The middle has moved a little bit to the right, but he is in the middle. I mean, it was Kennedy who determined lots of votes, 5-4 votes, but Roberts is the key. The other individual seems to be Kavanaugh, because Kavanaugh has not voted consistently with the conservative part of the court. And so even though Gorsuch, the other appointment from President Trump, has, but Kavanaugh has not. And so a wild card seems to be Kavanaugh in a number of votes.
Do we have any sense on how these justices feel about immigration issues as we look at their rulings and their writings?
Not much. I mean, we do know that they did approve the idea of the member of the Muslim ban. And the Muslim ban was vetoed by a number of courts or negated by a number of courts. But when it came up to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court said that the president can implement that. So they're at least more likely to go along with the president in a number of cases. And my guess is, as I say, in the DACA program, they would split exactly, you know, conservative, liberal members of the court, and it will be a 5-4 decision. And Roberts would go along with the conservative members of the court on the DACA situation.
We are talking with Ed Miller about Supreme Court rulings, getting your reaction as well at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the latest Supreme Court rulings? Are you optimistic about our government? Do you have questions about what came down as the term ended Thursday? Join in at 800-642-1234. Ed Miller is an emeritus political science professor, UW Stevens Point. Ed, let's look at the Supreme Court upholding a Wisconsin law that allows police to draw blood from suspected drunk drivers who are unconscious without a warrant. What did you see there about how the justices ruled on that?
Well, that was a 5-4 decision as well. So it was split. And this has to do with someone who's, for example, involved in an accident. And the question is, Did they drink? Well, if they're not unconscious, they can refuse to have their blood drawn. In Wisconsin, anyway, they can refuse to have their blood drawn to test their blood alcohol limits. Now, they would most likely lose their driver's license, but they can refuse. But what happens if somebody's unconscious? that was the issue before the court. Well, before that, they could get a judge ruling. You know, the question is the Fourth Amendment issue. Do they have a right to protect, to keep their blood safe? In other words, not keep it away from the authorities. But they can't make that determination because they're unconscious. But you could get a court to rule that the blood can be taken. So one side said that you need to get a warrant. And so if it's 3 o'clock in the morning, you can wake up a judge. And the judge can issue a warrant to be able to test the blood. The other side said, no, that's inconvenient, that the fact is that the police are, if it's a major accident, are involved in taking people to the hospital and the like. We should be able to get this blood. And that's how the court ruled. It was a 5-4 decision that if you're unconscious, that they can take your blood and test it for blood alcohol level. Because, and the other argument was that if there's a delay, the fact is that, you know, the blood alcohol level would then drop and you wouldn't get the level that existed at the time of the accident. So if it took a while to get a warrant, the argument, it would not be an accurate reading of the blood. And that was the contention in the case. This is interesting.
Oh, go ahead. What is interesting?
Yep. No, I was just going to say, this goes along with the court's ruling has to do with cars. And so if someone is driving a car and the police stop the car and they believe that the car is going to go, in other words, they're looking for contraband in the car. They have some suspicion that there's contraband in the car. The police, under Supreme Court decisions, can search that car. They can search the car. But if, on the other hand, the car is not going away, that's the analogy, that the blood would be going away because it would be diluted. But if the car situation, if they arrest the person and they've got the car, they're impounding the car, they cannot search that car unless they have a warrant. And so the general concept that the evidence is not going to be there in, you know, short period of time, like a car driving away or the blood, you know, reducing its blood alcohol level. That's the principle under which the court ruled.
Talking about recent court rulings, SCOTUS here on the morning show with Ed Miller. He's an emeritus professor of political science at UW Stevens Point. Our guide this hour, you can join in with your thoughts, your questions, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. What do you think of the Supreme Court rulings handed down this term? What are your questions about the decisions? Join in, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. The vast majority of SCOTUS cases originate in a lower court. One of the decisions that came down in this term was that police officers may order blood drawn without a warrant. We're talking about it here on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. 5-4 decision upheld a Wisconsin law that says people driving on a public road have implied consent to having their blood drawn if police suspect them of driving under the influence. Are you a police officer? What is your take on this ruling? How important is it to keep our roads safe? And drivers, are you concerned about the law enforcement's power to draw blood from you? What do you think after the Supreme Court upheld this law? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. And Ed Miller stays with us. He's an emeritus professor of political science at UW Stevens Point. So Ed, the CEO of Mothers Against Drunk Driving spoke in support of the Supreme Court's decision last week.
When they're so drunk that they're unconscious, and then you have to wait for them to regain consciousness, then what you're going to have is the evidence, meaning their blood BAC is going to dissipate by the minute.
So this is what you were referring to, that time is really important here to get the accuracy needed for what could come next in the legal process.
Right. The other side argues that it's a blow to the Fourth Amendment, you know, the protection under the Fourth Amendment that you need to get a warrant to search something. And they said that a judge is always available. They said that you can wake up a judge at 3 o'clock in the morning. So the idea that you can get a judge to issue that warrant. So those are the two sides of the issue.
So in 2013, Sheboygan police arrested Gerald Mitchell, and this initial test showed his blood alcohol content was 3 times the legal limit, and it was later drawn for another test while he was unconscious. So what do we know about how this law stems from this 2013 case?
Well, it'll be that they can use the blood since he was unconscious, and there's actually that's one case, but there's other cases waiting in Wisconsin before the Supreme Court case whether they can use the blood that was drawn. It also in some way interacts the federal law that protects your medical records, and that particular law says that your medical records cannot be disclosed, and that's medical privacy. And in that particular, the question is, does that law apply with regard to your blood as well?
So could the Supreme Court's decision impact any pending litigation with similar questions? Are there similar things out there?
Oh, there's several cases out there. And so what the Supreme Court means is that the blood can be drawn. Somebody's unconscious from an automobile accident. They can draw the blood, and the results of that be used as evidence in court. And there would not be a Fourth Amendment challenge to suppress that evidence.
Let's go to Steve now in Sun Prairie with thoughts on this. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Good morning.
I'm more libertarian, so I'm against, the court even ordering, having the ability to order someone to have their blood withdrawn. I mean, people that are pro-choice believe you have the right to your body. Well, how is this any different? A judge, whether it's a judge or the cop, saying I can extract something from your body, it's just wrong.
Steve, thanks for the call. So, I mean, Steve coming down very heavily on this other side here.
Right. That would be a Fourth Amendment protection. And that would be under the idea is that, not only is your items that you have in your house protected, against police searches, but so is your body. But in this particular case, the court ruled that there is, as you mentioned, an implied consent. That, in fact, is that you're driving on the street, you have a license, and so, therefore, the police can do that. I mean, and it was a 5-4 decision, so you can see the justices were split conservative and liberal on this issue.
Ed Miller, looking ahead at the big cases the Supreme Court is expected to hear, and one including a review of gay and transgender rights in the workplace, can you tell us about what is going on in that case?
Yes. The gay and transgender rights, there's no federal protection for individuals who are gay or transgender. And so the question is, and there's been several attempts to get it through the Congress, and they've come pretty close, but that's not been enacted. Now, there are state laws that protect gay and transgender, including Wisconsin, which was an early one, early adopter. But there's no federal law. However, there is federal laws to protect people based upon sex. And the question is that those laws that based upon sex, which was initially enacted for gender in terms of male and female, does that apply to protecting gay and transgender people, whether it's in the workforce or employment in the workforce, or whether it's discrimination in some other way, or it's schools. And so what the Obama administration did was it ruled that the use of the word sex in a number of laws do apply to protect gay and transgender people. The Trump administration argues that this does not, that it doesn't apply to them at all. So that is the fight. And that is, how do you interpret that particular term, sex, in a number of statutes? Is it broadly interpreted, or is it very narrowly interpreted in the statute? Regardless of the way it was initially, so the one argument is that it's not, you go back to when it was put in. And you look at those laws, and those laws were not intended to apply to gay or transgender people. On the other hand, things do evolve and things do change. And the question is, does a contemporary reading of this law then protect gay and transgender? So the Obama administration interpreted one way, the Trump administration interpreted a different way, and the court will decide.
Yeah, so could the high court ruling, change anything here in Wisconsin if we already have a state law, or for that matter, other states that have a state law?
No, it would not change things in Wisconsin because you would be under state law. You'd be protected by state law. But there's quite a number of states that do not have a state law. And these individuals could be fired from their job because they're gay or transgender. They could be denied housing if they're gay or transgender, and so forth. And so there's no protection there. So there's been an attempt many times to enact this particular law to protect these individuals. It got very, very close. But in the last enactment, what happened was that it was not just gay. They added transgender. And even though there was a clear majority in both the House and the Senate to protect gay people, there was a controversy over the transgender component to it. And this was around the time where the question of bathrooms came up, in North Carolina and the like. And so it lost by a very narrow margin in Congress, this particular law, the ENDO law.
Ed, thank you so much for joining us in your analysis.
Yeah, I'm very happy to be with you.
Ed Miller is an emeritus professor of political science at UW-Stevens Point. Join us tomorrow for a midsummer celebration featuring music, storytelling, and comedy from the shores of the Mississippi River. We'll celebrate the holiday with laughs and music from guests, including Twin Cities comedian Amber Preston, Northern Wisconsin cellist Ed Willett, River Falls poet Thomas Smith, and a trio of La Crosse area acoustic musicians. It is the Big River Radio Wave Independence Day special, and it happens at 6 o'clock. Tomorrow on the Ideas Network. That's 6 o'clock for the Big River Radio Wave Independence Day special. Just ahead, how multi-level marketing companies work, who they target. Do you work for a multi-level marketing company and do you like it or are you trying to get out of it? Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Your personal stories about working MLMs, they're welcome as well. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.